This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. As always, you can join our conversation about the week's news at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can call us at 860-275-7266 if you want to join us today. Colin McEnroe is here, as always. He's host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
In order to offset the leanings of the other two panelists today, I am going to be a Republican woman.
Okay, excellent.
Not again.
Good. Good luck.
You Democrats!
It's been like every other Wednesday now for over a year.
You libs!
Also here with us is Bill Curry. He's a Democratic political analyst. Hi there, Bill.
Morning, sir. Nice to be here with you, as always.
And joining us from our new studio at Gateway Community College in New Haven is Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent. Hey there, Paul.
Good morning, John.
And again, if you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. So these gubernatorial candidate forums on the Democratic side, really on the Republican side too, have been pretty sedate, maybe a little bit boring, at least if you don't count the one where Lee Whitnum got dragged off stage. Maybe more on that a bit later on. But this past Sunday in New Haven, a couple of the top candidates kind of got into it a little bit. Here's a little clip of a video that Paul got for the New Haven Independent website. Here's Susan Bisewitz addressing fellow frontrunner Ned Lamont.
I am very passionate about clean elections, and so my question is for Ned Lamont. Ned, will you agree to spend $1.2 million, which is what all of us would qualify for, from the convention through the primary?
Okay, so Paul Bass, that's Susan Bisewitz asking a direct question to Ned Lamont. What did Ned Lamont say?
Well, first, Ned took a gentlemanly Greenwich dig at her by saying, Susan, I seem to remember when you ran for attorney general, you did not run clean at the citizen elections campaign. But Ned ducked the question. He said, so many people are giving me individual donations, which is true. He has more than the others, candidates running for office. He said that we're running against Republicans who will have a lot of money in November, so we need someone who can raise the money, which is really the quiet pitch that he's been using in New Haven and getting a lot of people to his side. I'm the rich guy who can bankroll my own campaign for $10 million, so go with me. So she shot back and said, but well, I'm not talking about running against Republicans. I phrased my question. I guess she's finally learned how to practice law since the embarrassment 8 years ago when she tried to argue to a judge that she'd been a lawyer. She said, no, I phrased my question carefully. I said, what about in the primary? We have some other candidates and I are running under the Clean Elections Program, public financing. That limits how much we can spend. Why do you need to spend more than us? And it was an interesting debate because obviously the background was that Lamont is pulling ahead from Susan Bisewitz pretty quickly. And a week earlier, the AFL-CIO, he cleaned up at a straw poll they gave. He had more than anybody else combined in support, which was kind of interesting, but he pointed that out in the debate, being kind of self-made. Well, not self-made, he inherited his money, but, you know, a guy who made a lot of money in business, and he's not in government, and he's winning the AFL-CIO support. So she was trying to find his one vulnerable position, because when then Mott last ran for governor, the people who had previously supported him as a Senate campaign ditched him on the public finance issue. The people who recruited him to be a candidate for Senate in 2006 ditched him in the 2010 governor's race, because he was self-financing. They felt that was an important principle. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to rise to a lot in this campaign. I don't think people care that much, but it was an interesting moment.
Colin?
Well, yeah, just 2 points here. I'll do come in kind of reverse order to Paul's second point here. With the Democrats, to the extent that they have any kind of centralized leadership or any kind of organization or ability to sail their own ship in a specific direction, they really want to crown— Which is an open question. They really want to crown Lamont right now. They would like to crown him at the convention. They would like him to have, because of the Republican disarray, which we'll be talking about in a little while, they see an opportunity. If they can kind of plow the road for Lamont, get him into the summer where maybe his only primary opponent is Joe Ganim, then he can sort of be, first of all, this white knight running against Joe Ganim, and they can really establish him as a candidate while the Republicans are still fighting out this really multi-part thing. But just to go back to, and I just have to say that, first of all, as a journalist and also as a Republican woman, I don't really care who wins the Democratic nomination, but I'm mildly offended by Susan Bisewitz on this, because as Paul and Ned have now pointed out, it wasn't just that she didn't seek the Citizens Election Program in 2010. She had been a passionate advocate of it as a form of good election reform and clean election reform. And then it turned out, oh, but me? No, I'm not doing that. I am raising money in large amounts. And then when her if you go back to this that time, too. Remember, she also had a little bit of problem, and it turned out there was a 36,000 voter database inside her Secretary of State's office that looked kind of like political information as opposed to civic information. Then at the end of her campaign, she was cited by the State Election Enforcement Commission for some of the handling of this money raised from private sources. In particular, she spent $45,000 after her campaign had ended. And a cynical person might have looked at that $45,000 expenditure and thought, wow, I wonder if she's sort of, you know, spreading a little bit of good cheer around right now for if she just by some miracle happened to run for Senate 2 years later, which is exactly what happened. So I don't know. I don't really think that she's on good footing. I realize this is all ancient history. It's all 8 and 6 years ago. I don't think she's on good footing taking jabs at Lamont about his participation or lack thereof in the CEP.
You're so conveniently using things that happened in the past to suggest right. that maybe something now might be true. I don't know. Is he looking at it the right way, Bill?
Well, I mean to say, speaking for an older generation for whom 8 years ago and last weekend are interchangeable
it's
concepts.
About the same thing.
I think this is a little more than fly specking on Colin's part. I'd say a couple things. First of all, that to think for a moment, just to step back and look at the context of this, the state has huge problems. Again, we confuse them. Our economy has real problems, but our government has huge problems. And you have the largest fields in both parties to run for governor in my memory. So you have the biggest problems and the most candidates and the fewest big ideas. And so what do we finally have in a debate to talk about but a discussion which is really just another proxy for character, each person calling the other person some kind of a hypocrite. Ned, in his defense, pointing it out, there's no other response except the one that Ned and Colin just made. But one, everybody be better off talking about the half dozen huge problems that some governor needs to solve. And the second thing I would just point out is that I was reminded listening to this of Ned, whom I like very much. But I remember his debate against Lieberman when Lieberman saying about the Iraq War to the people of Connecticut, who by that time had really turned on it, "I hear you," and implying falsely that he'd some way agreed with them and had heard them and was listening to them. Okay. And there was a moment where you wanted Ned to just pounce and say, okay, let's just walk through that. And I think that I contrast it not only – I remember – compare it to that debate so many years ago. And then I contrast it with what Colin just did, which was really pick it apart. And there's a moment like that and as much as I want this to be substantive and as much as I want it to be positive and as much as I yearn for civility in our discourse, there comes a moment like that where Ned has to turn and make that the case that he's running against a purely transactional candidate. And you only do that not with name-calling but with elaboration. If he wants to be governor, he's going to have to be a little bit better at filling in all the lacunae in this debate and making sure that when the point has been made, it's really been made.
Paul, you suggested earlier that this issue might not be something that is rising to the top of the list of things people are really caring about as they look for a Democratic nominee for governor. You talked with Tony Harp, a very influential member of the party in New Haven, who seems to think that, you know, public financing, not that big a deal.
She had an interesting argument. She said it should even the playing field, but not define the playing field. But there's another unanswered question, I think, in that argument. I agree it's a little bit small bore, but do you need a lot of money to win? How much money do you need, or is there a point of no return? When Linda McMahon spent $50 million against Chris Murphy, $50 million against Dick Blumenthal, they didn't have anywhere that kind of money, but they had enough. When Ned Lamont spent $10 million trying to beat Dan Malloy in a primary in 2010, he had public financing, he had a third as much money, but he had enough to win. So one question I have is whether the Democrats are going to pick a candidate because he's the richest guy but has like zero vision or it would never interest anybody. Or are they going to try and find someone who has vision and leadership and ideas? I don't know.
Well, you know, Paul, can I ask you a question? Because you've really talked to probably more candidates, well, certainly more candidates than all of us sitting in this room combined at this point. Who does anybody strike you as having vision, as having – I mean, is there any conversation you've walked away from thinking, wow, that person's ideas should – you know?
I actually like all six of them personally. I spent, an hour with each of them in conversation on the radio. No one stands out with all of the aspects of what you need. Lamont has the most money. Harris and Connolly clearly have the most policy grasp and the most interesting ideas. Ghanem is the only one who really knows what it means to lead something. The question is, does he lead everybody to jail or a casino? You know, so I don't think there's one person. I think Susan's not connecting. That's really what the debate was about. Susan started out with a lot of strength, name recognition. She's a very tireless campaigner and fundraiser, and she's just going flat. I mean, everyone in that room told me after that it's not that they had a candidate. They all said, yeah, Harris and Connolly knew what they were talking about. They're not going to win. Susan Bicewicz doesn't connect with anybody, so I guess it's the default be Lamont, which makes me wonder what happens if Aaron Stewart does have substance, the Republican Party. What if they don't shoot themselves in the foot the way they always do and somehow blow elections that they're supposed to win easily, and they put a young woman who can appeal to Latinos and Democrats and city voters? I mean, they're trying to, you know, obviously the conservatives and the Republican Party are trying to destroy her before she starts. But how does Ned Lamont run against that?
Can I just say one quick thing about that? Because I do think that the early part of a campaign is an introduction, right? Nobody knows any of these people. I mean, we know who these people are. We've been covering them for a really long time. But the average person out there, they don't know any of these people. So the early part of a campaign is an introduction.
And we don't know all of them.
We don't know all of them. Yeah, exactly. Although, and this is when you're meeting the people. And policy tends to, if you know, emerges at all, it'll come later in the campaign. So right now, let's say Lamont winds up being the nominee. A lot of this is kind of the introduction. Who is this guy? And which is actually a question that Joe Lieberman asked him in that debate that Bill mentioned. But I think Lamont can plausibly run as the guy who, given a set of choices, will do everything in his power to do the right thing. And I think that rings true about Lamont, too, that he will try to do the right thing. If I were him, if I were his campaign handlers, I would make that a big focus of the campaign. And I think that will stand him in good stead, even if he runs against a somewhat more dynamic Republican.
Bill?
A couple things. First of all, what Paul said about how much is enough is an interesting question, and it also pertains to this in a very practical way, which is that I don't think Lamont's financial advantage is about the general election. I think it's entirely about the primary, that he has that much money that quickly. I know that's what a lot of political tacticians have thought about. And so this will weigh heavily in the primary. And the $6 million in funding for a governor's race in the general election, that is plenty. The point about McMahon and Foley, what struck me most about McMahon and Foley was their second races. And they'd spent so much money on pollsters and consultants who told them that all they needed was the right meme, the right slogan, the good ad, that they didn't do any homework. I think they lost their first elections because they'd fared so poorly in debates by revealing their lack of grasp of public policy. They came back 2 years later and did the same thing again.
Can I ask you a question about all this? Because I think you got a really interesting perspective on this. And I almost never say that. And like, in fact, write that down.
What is the word almost doing in that sentence? What is the word almost doing in that sentence?
9/18 on April 25th. Go
ahead. So, if in fact we're witnessing an attempt at a coronation of Lamont, are the Democrats making this mistake in Connecticut in 2018 that they made nationally in 2016, which is try to pick a winner and maybe leave a whole bunch of constituencies feeling like they haven't been listened to?
Well, let me say, the National Party has been doing that all over the country and in all kinds of races. And here I would just say, first of all, the Democratic Party could screw up a two-car funeral. Its ability to organize these things is far less than outsiders or conspiracy theorists think. And they've bought, and to your point, they've bought this idea that primaries are about division when primaries are really about renewal. The reason this is an octogenarian, sclerotic party is that, unlike the Republicans, we stopped having primaries. We have, since Nancy Pelosi became Speaker, we've had three popes, okay? So this is not – we're not moving forward. We need that kind of debate. To go to go just back to this question for a second, I do think that the point about Lamont is that, unlike McMahon – and Foley, he went out and started a public policy institute in Central Connecticut, and he poured a lot of time and energy in it. He did a lot of reading.
So did Foley.
He has
Foley
to show
started
it.
One in this building. Foley started a
between
public
elections.
Building. Yes,
I'm surprised. Then let me say that the lesson for Foley, I didn't know that. Thank you. The lesson from Foley then for Ned is, make sure you apply that in public. This is about out there. I do believe in my heart, it's not just being some kind of Boy Scout about this. There is a hunger for content
as well as authenticity. People want to hear. They know these problems are big, and they want to hear some solutions. The person who gets closest to that, I think, has a better chance than the person with the best, you know, personality.
Let me give you an example. Can I give an example of when there actually was content in this debate? So there was these quick questions to candidates, yes or no. Do you support MGM getting a casino in Bridgeport? They all said yes. Is gambling an aggressive tax on the poor? Lamont, Harris, and Bice would say yes. So I asked them after, if it's an aggressive tax on the poor, how could you be for the casino? And Ned's answer was, well, let's stop calling them casinos. 30% of the revenue is casino gambling, 70% is resorts. Let's call them resorts. I don't know. Is that authenticity, Bill? Is that policy smarts?
All these wealthy candidates have spent too much time fermenting with consultants and pollsters and learning to handle questions with that kind of language. I think Ned's a lot better when he's being a little more spontaneous than that and a little more substantive. People are afraid right now in this primary because Unite Here is so strong on this question of a casino.
I call them Native American reparations, by the way. I don't even call them resorts.
Well, that's what all Republican
We got to take a break here,
but I want to get to a quick call from Jeff, who's calling from New London. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Hey, how are you? I heard your conversation about Ned Lamont earlier, and certainly at a straw poll I was part of, he had a lot of energy, a lot more than Bicewicz. But I think we haven't talked about lieutenant governor choices, and I know Lamont's been talking to some people and has a short list, but I think if he picked Eva Bermudez, that would go a long way to connecting him to the working class, you know, in a way that I don't think any amount of other balancing the ticket with the other candidates could do.
Well, hey, Jeff, thanks for that. Colin, we just have a moment here. I mean, should we be talking at this point about potential lieutenant governor picks? We're going to be talking about that on the Republican side right after this break.
I think it's a legitimate problem, partly because they've got to have, I mean, if the LG is not a woman of color, they've probably made kind of a tactical mistake here. I said this last week, there's no guarantee that they can get a person of color onto the statewide ticket any other way. I mean, the treasurer is the most obvious path, but in terms of it being an African-American, that would be Sean Wooden, but there are other strong candidates in that field. So, yeah, I would expect Lamont, if he's the nominee, I'm not doing a coronation yet, if he's the nominee, he's going to look around for a woman of color.
Tim Kaine couldn't sell Bill Clinton. I mean, Tim Kaine couldn't sell Hillary Clinton, the working class. No one's going to sell Ned Lamont any more than in 2010 when he paid a lot of people to work for him.
I know no one competing in the system currently believes this, but if they spend as much serious time on the platform, which most of the delegates don't even know exists, and actually thought through how do we run on this, how do we make this a blueprint for change, and they took all the time they're spending on rules, and the rules problems usually sort themselves out, and the under ticket, which also has a way of setting itself up politically at the convention, and focused on what we stand for, they'd be better off.
Why do you always bring it back to policy, Bill?
It's a genetic flaw. I've tried to have this removed. I had surgery.
The dude who called wanted to know about Lieutenant Governor.
Bill.
I still blame
Bill
you.
Bill Curry is our Democratic
After
political
Lieberman,
analyst.
You're the guy I blame the most.
Paul
the most
Bass part. Is editor of the New Haven Independent.
Who is
Colin McEnroe is host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. I'm John Dankosky. We're going to come back and talk more about the week's news in the wheelhouse right after this. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can give us a call at 860-275-7266. Joining us from New Haven today is Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent. Bill Curry is our Democratic political analyst. And our own Colin McEnroe is here. What's on your show today, Colin?
Well, significantly, we are doing a show about the candidates who don't get invited to talk to editorial boards or be at debates, and they don't get a lot of money either. Every cycle we do, get to know your fringe candidates. We'll be talking to three of them today, including an already on tape interview with Lee Whitnum, which I recommend people listening to. One interesting thing about fringe candidates, if I may use that term, is that they're Bill's dream. They only want to talk about policy. I mean, in fact, in negotiating with them about having them be on this show, their big concern is, can I talk about policy? All these other candidates, the ones with the money and the support and the advertising, they'll do anything to avoid a conversation about policy. These people actually do. That's the only thing they care about. That's why they're doing this.
Paul, very quickly, I mean, is that you talk to all these candidates on the radio and sitting down with them? Do you agree with Colin?
I agree with his analysis of what happens in public. I think they all could talk, most of them could talk pretty intelligently about a lot of policy. And the one thing that isn't being said is this, there has been a consensus in these Democratic forums and in the interviews on a whole set of positions that did not used to form a consensus for the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody now supports legalized marijuana for recreational use in some form. Everyone supports tolls. You know, they're just talking about who has a smarter idea about how to do it. Everyone supports sanctuary cities, they say, even if President Trump tries to defund us. Those are, you know, and those aren't the only ones. And there's a pretty, so there is a policy consensus of what Democrats stand for, and Republicans, I think.
Yeah, although the consensus breaks down about, and when you get to things like political reform, tax structure, economic development, the distribution of wealth, power, income, and opportunity, and it
Good
especially
point.
Breaks down in terms of specifics. Democrats are all great on cultural issues, and they all think the same thing. There's just one Democratic candidate traveling the country with all those same views. Where the Democrats let the public down are in the things the public thinks the government's actually in charge of fixing and most urgently needs fixing.
Well, let's go to a candidate that Paul had mentioned earlier. This is Aaron Stewart, the Republican mayor of New Britain. Here she is with WTNH's Mark Davis announcing her running mate, Greenwich First Electman Peter Tesi.
Peter's a great addition to the Team Stewart ticket, and it's going to be a great run as we go into the convention on May 12th.
We've been talking about Aaron Stewart for some time, Colin, so she makes a pick, someone from a town that's very different from hers, someone who's already thrown his support fully behind her. I don't know, a smart move by Aaron Stewart?
No, it is a smart move. Kevin Rennie's already pointed out that in the past she's sort of pitted the interests of New Britain against the interests of Greenwich. But
as one would do as a mayor
another
of any
fly specker that
yeah,
Rennie.
That's right. Yeah. Well, yeah.
But you know, look, here, the Republicans have kind of a different problem. I mean, we really do have no way to plow the road that I can see anyway. I should point out they're having their convention at a resort called Foxwoods, they've got a very crowded field. I don't see Tim Herbst or Mark Boughton getting out of the way for Aaron Stewart. I mean, not at the convention. I would expect them to all three of them come out of there with the requisite 15% to campaign, at which point they're going to run into a few rich guys who aren't even bothering with the convention. They're doing signature campaigns. This is the crowded field. And unless I have tried to look into the mind of state Republican Chairman J.R. Romano, and unfortunately all I find are old Maxim magazines and empty whiskey bottles, but maybe he's got some kind of master plan. They've lifted their
allegedly.
Schedule.
Yeah, they, allegedly.
Yeah, that's right. They've listed their schedule at the resort as running till midnight on Saturday night. Their schedule says that their session Saturday is from 8 a.m. to midnight at a casino where, of course, nobody's going to want to leave this really interesting convention and go sample the delights of the casino. I don't know. I have no idea how anybody expects to get out of there with anything except chaos.
Here's what an under ticket is about at a convention. One, it's about getting the votes to be nominated. And secondly, it's about uniting the party around you. It's not really about broadening, as Paul was saying earlier about vice presidential candidates, it's not really about broadening your appeal to the public. And that is entirely about message. And again, just if you take a look at what the debate over who's a hypocrite at the start, all the debates over rules, the discussions about lieutenant governor. I did a Facebook post yesterday about the fact that the community college merger failed. I wrote about it in December. It's a massive issue for at least two community colleges that are now on Mr. Jenkins' hit list, and a dollar prize to the first candidate in either party who brings it up. There was a time when a thing like that would hit, and everybody would realize they had to stop and speak to it. We have so many issues like that. When I think of it, Paul was as always very generous to all the candidates. I've gone down all their websites, and I don't see much. And I'm trying to be fair about it. And, you know, I think Sean and Jonathan are good candidates.
You know, we're talking about the Republicans now, right?
No, I'm going back to the Democrats. But I went to both. I'm now going back to the Democrats for one second.
Well, very quickly.
Mike Candler does know a lot about policy and how to run the government.
They do. I don't see it. But I went across the board. I don't see it. And to go back just for a second to Jonathan and Sean, the Republicans would like to make this about whether it's another third term for Dan Malloy. They're vulnerable on that. But the whole Democratic Party is vulnerable about it unless they can make this about what we're going to do to solve these problems. Well, that's their only hope.
Okay, well, Paul, what about on the Republican side? I mean, are you convinced by Aaron Stewart as a front-running candidate for governor?
I'm not convinced for two reasons. One is I don't really know her. I don't know if, like, they're right that she has no substance. Chris Powell did a hit on her. She didn't know anything about pensions. I'm just looking at biography. And I also know that the conservative wing of the Republican Party wants to make sure she gets nowhere because she raised taxes, because people of color vote for her. She's pro-choice. But I don't understand if she can get into a general election and if they make her not sound like an idiot. I don't see how you can run against a young woman who has crossover appeal in a state where the biggest block of voters is independent. I don't understand why the Republican Party doesn't want to win in a general election.
Colin, that's the thing I was just about to ask you. The idea that the conservative wing of the party says, you know what we don't want in there is someone who could broadly appeal to people in cities. That's the last thing we want.
Right. Well, I mean, this is the dilemma of the Republican Party locally and nationally, that both parties have this problem. They have to run to the extremes during the primaries. So everybody's a gun nut during the primaries, but that maybe doesn't work so well during the general election. So you pivot. She'll try to pivot. I agree with something Paul just said, which is, like, everybody is a brilliant, wonderful, genius candidate until they start running. And then we'll see. Mike Tyson famously said everybody has a plan until they get hit. And I don't know. Erin Stewart I don't know whether she's a good statewide candidate or not. I mean, because nobody's ever really looked at her that way. We'll find out.
We got to take a break. That's Colin McEnroe. We're also hearing from Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, and Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent. Right now, we're going to go to some friends who are in the other room. They're going to ask for your support because we're in the middle of a fundraiser right now. We got to raise money for shows like The Wheelhouse and Where We Live, for the Colin McEnroe Show, and everything else that you hear. You can give us a pledge right now, and here are some friends to tell you how. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can always join our conversation about the week's news at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse, or call us at 860-275-7266. We're joined today by the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network. They provide an invaluable and independent, we hope, resource to the people of Connecticut, showing what's going on in state government. Colin McEnroe is here, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, is here as well. And Paul Bass joins us from New Haven. He's editor of the New Haven Independent. On Monday, Richard Robinson, Governor Malloy's second choice to be Chief Justice of the Connecticut Supreme Court, took about 3 hours of questions from state lawmakers at his confirmation hearing. That is about a quarter of the grilling that was endured by the first pick, Andrew McDonald, whose nomination was eventually voted down in the Senate last month. Here's Justice Robinson's response when asked what he would do if the rule of law conflicted with his personal sense of justice.
I think it's critical that I follow the rule of law, because that way you have a system of justice that is equal to everybody. Now, if I end up in a place I don't like, I still write that decision. But if it's because of a statute, I have a Tuesday in November to deal with that. And I go, and I can still speak to, although I can't be political, I can still speak to my representative, my state representative.
So that's Richard Robinson at his nomination hearing. Colin, obviously going a lot better than it was for Andrew McDonald. Mark Pazniokas, our friend of the Connecticut Mirror, writes a story with the headline, "Expectations High for a Groundbreaking Court Nominee." Should this have been the first choice?
Well, I think you can make the argument that it should have been the first choice. That's obviously somewhat with the benefit of hindsight, but I think it was pretty obvious from the beginning that this was – well, let me just back up and say one thing. This is kind of a weird, interesting little statistic. There are 7 active members of the Supreme Court. There are a couple others on senior status, but the Supreme Court in Connecticut is 7 people. If Ecker, who is the guy who's kind of the next in line, is approved, 6 of them – will be Dan Malloy nominees. The 7th, Dick Palmer, was a Lowell Weicker nominee. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, Malloy really will have wound up having a big, big impact on the Supreme Court. He appointed Rick Robinson to be Associate Justice. I assume that the way is very clear for Robinson to be Chief Justice. The Republicans kind of slobbered all over him when they were talking about how much they didn't like Andrew McDonald. Lynn Fasano made it clear that he sees no real material difference between Rick Robinson and Thurgood Marshall. So, I don't see – they don't really have any choice but to confirm him at this point. And I don't know. Anybody could say, well, they should have done it this way in the first place, but that's a little bit with the benefit of hindsight.
Bill?
A couple of things. It actually bothered me that the Republicans and the committee didn't ask him any issue questions at all. He skated, and
we've done this thing with all judicial nominations, especially the federal level, where really the hearing for the confirmation is just a glorified FBI thing. If your character checks out, you're okay. Unless you have what we have in Connecticut, which is the seeping over into the judiciary of the kind of Jersey Shore politics of our time that gave us Trump and that Trump amplifies. There was a dispute in the court years ago that's been well covered, in which there was a question of whether a Pete Zarella decision was being withheld from the legislature prior to a confirmation. And the feelings then of some judges, I guess, that you shouldn't be withholding from the legislature substantive policy views that might figure in their judgments. That has set off this decades-long acrimonious Kardashian Jersey Shore kind of backbiting thing that came out a lot in the Andrew McDonald thing. I hope that all those people just, you know, take their politics out of the judicial branch. It's the last functioning. We have three branches. Only one's left that's working. If this kind of politics gets into it, it stops working too. Too much partisanship, too much personality. It took down Andrew McDonald, whatever else you may think of him. And you see it going on far too much.
And to Bill's point, Paul, you know, we see our friend Ken Dixon and his colleagues at the Connecticut Post writing that former Supreme Court justices drew a roadmap for McDonald defeat. Ian McLaughlin, who served on the court from 2009 to 2012, provided advice to Republicans on strategies to take him down. And Peter Zarella, aforementioned, who served on the high court at the same time as McDonald, also participated in a secret effort to defeat McDonald. A couple weeks ago, Paul, we were talking about how this had gotten so partisan just in the legislature as it tries to confirm a nominee. It's actually including partisanship within former justices.
Yeah, I love that Ken Dixon story. That was great. For me, it kind of points up in these judgment discussions how partisanship is defined as liberal. So I remember Jeff Sessions grilling Sonia Sotomayor saying, "Are you an identity politics person?" Jeff Sessions, the number one white nationalist identity policy person in government, who says that he thought the Ku Klux Klan was good guys till he found out they smoked pot. And in this case, too, I mean, it's you know, I think that we got that kind of policy. What struck me about the Robinson story, that great story by Mark Pazniokas, it starts out when he's in a Litchfield store, hardware store, and they think he's shoplifting because he's black. Remember Fleming Norcott was a black state Supreme Court justice. He was getting his car washed, so he's in sweats in New Haven one day on Willie Avenue. He got pulled over because he's driving a nice car. These suburban legislators in the Republican Party now who want to act like, just like all those people said, I voted for Barack Obama, so I can't be racist. They come from all these suburban towns where they profile and harass and treat black people of all income labels terrible. But now they're going to be able to say, look, we supported this black judge when, in fact, they hijacked the politics of this judicial process from the beginning. The other thing that really struck me in terms of how you define partisanship, during the debate over McDonald, and this is a hard thing to say, we feel so terrible about what Mr. Pettit went through and his family, and we do, and we give him a lot of extra room for how to behave in public because we all think he experienced one of the most horrible things we ever could experience. He went into politics and he had a personal grudge against McDonald because of the death penalty, because the brutal killer of his family did not get killed because of a policy that Andrew McDonald helped shape. He got revenge in a public forum in the legislature helping to lead the Republican charge against him. That was not considered partisan. But because McDonald, like any other person in public life, has helped shape policy over the years, supposedly had a conflict of interest because he did not support capital punishment. The Republicans have succeeded in defining partisanship as being not on their side.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of say, add to what Paul just said, I'd like to get rid of the term activist judge as something that's a blanket condemnation of liberal-leaning judges. I mean, look, there are activist judges all over the ideological spectrum. Scalia was an incredibly activist judge. If we mean results-oriented, you know, desirous of getting to a certain result and using your legal argument to get to that result, Citizens United is an incredibly activist judge decision. Bush v. Gore is an activist judge decision. We should stop using that term, too. I will quickly say that the other part of this is that Dan Malloy also has a whole raft of Superior Court judge nominees, including occasional but probably never again wheelhouse panelist Dan Clow. So far, it looks like in the legislature, they're going to make the argument that they can't afford them. I don't think they could do that with Rick Robinson and Ecker, the guy who's going to fill. I mean, they have to fill the whole Supreme Court. But they're it's possible that all the other nominees for Superior Court will be fought by the Republicans on the basis of they just cost too much money.
It costs too much money to have judges. Yeah, Bill, quick thought?
I just want to underscore what I said before. Just look at this, whether it's sort of Kardashian, Jersey Shore, Celebrity Apprentice, personality politics. Think about Trump and think about this discussion of our state Supreme Court. All about personal feuds. Everyone in a straitjacket of ideology and a subtext of race. This is what's happening in our entire country right now. And when it infiltrates the last branch of government that is functioning, that's a really sad day. And what all these stories from McDonald through Robinson, you know, they remind me that that's happening.
Lamar Odom has been a very good appellate judge, though. I think it's fair to say. You can condemn the Kardashians
all you want. All Republican women feel that way.
let's turn to another story here. I'm reading from Christine Stewart, CTNewsJunkie.com. A controversial plan to merge the state's community college system into one accredited body has been resoundingly rejected by the New England Association of Schools and Colleges Higher Education Commission. The plan, called Students First, and which was a year in the making, was proposed to save millions of dollars. Mark Ajakian says that this is devastating. Paul, what's your take on this? You're sitting right now at our studio in a community college in downtown New Haven. What are you thinking about this plan going away?
Well, obviously, ideologically, I agree with Bill Curry very much, and he knows a lot more about this than I do, and he makes a very good case, especially when we talk about preparing people for the jobs of the future. Community colleges have become the engines of opportunity, not just for people who are we consider college age, but what happened here at Gateway under Dorsey Kendrick when she was president, the way it grew was that it and became more meaningful is that it added retraining opportunities for people working in factories or losing jobs, working at night classes. They've done a lot with nursing and nurse assistants. Sometimes you have to test your ideology against real experience. Paul Brody, who's taken over both the Bridgeport and New Haven campuses, he has made some smart moves on consolidation, not just the usual that you say that people overestimate how much you can save in overhead. But, you know, in terms of certain kind of programs for automotive work, for instance, up here, they can combine those or ones they have down in Bridgeport. Consolidation isn't always wrong. It's always oversold as how much money you can spend by save by both parties. And there's a real cost system-wide in cutting back further on community colleges because of the importance when you look at the Trump vote in the country and the people being left behind by globalization and technological change. The rubber meets the road at community colleges, but that doesn't mean here and there you can't sometimes find efficiencies.
Well, and Bill, to that point, the Ajakian plan to do massive reorganization and provide a lot of consolidation of services, cutting out at least in the terms that they give, a lot of the top administrators, not turning it into just one big community college, but definitely consolidating things. It seems right now that there are two options left. One is a plan like that, which has been rejected, or a plan which seems likely, which is they're going to start closing some community colleges.
Yeah, let me just say it. I don't want to cast aspersions on the integrity of anyone involved here. And I've known Mark Ajakian a long time. He's a fine public servant. We disagree strongly about this. And I think about our overall theory of government. But one, the community colleges are so good because of their democratic character, and that stems from their scale and their autonomy. And this proposal was to rip out their provost, their president, and to put everything in an insular bureaucracy far away. That means you have to take the word community out, and it means you've lost faith in how well those principles have worked for you, what kind of institution has made it. The savings I went over strongly, they weren't really there. And so actually, Mark's statement yesterday I find highly questionable in that he really knew that those savings were – I assume he knew those savings weren't there to begin with. These closings were about to be proposed. The one small gift here is of a fig leaf to the board, which wanted to do the consolidation and then the closings. And the savings that are available, there are some available, and they have nothing to do with the merger. There's a consolidation of activities, of financing, back office stuff. The only question I had reading was why I thought it must have been done 10 years ago, and it hadn't been. I would just go to a point Colin's been making a lot lately about the quality of debate. We've exchanged our democratic values for highly technocratic values, and those technocratic elites like to deal in secret. They actually feel that the whole country's a bunch of deplorables sometimes, it seems, like the public just has to be kept out of the process. There's a chance now. A regional accrediting agency did what our own legislature and our own Board of Regents should have done. They've given us one last chance to do this right. and to kick off a truly public and inclusive and substantive discussion about this precious asset.
Including, as you said before, one that probably should be part of this governor's race right now. Colin?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the important thing to mention is it's not a functioning system, a well-functioning system. It's a broken system, and it does need an overhaul. And the title of the Ojakian plan was Students First. That's what it should be. There's only one real question. The question is, can a student walk through the gates of any of these facilities, any of these institutions, and get what that student needs to receive an associate degree or a bachelor's degree without having to wander all over the firmament looking for other courses that aren't offered on the campus, not having adequately trained academic advisors, and the use of adjuncts in this system? They are the Jodes of higher education anyway. If Steinbeck were alive, he'd do a novel about adjuncts. It's not fair to them, and it's not fair to the students either. A lot of these adjuncts are literally in a position where they have to leave their classes and race to another campus where they're teaching for really bad money. So let's start with the students. Let's start with the students and say, how do we at least standardize the system so you know what you need to get in the shortest amount of time, and it's there for you? I think that calculus has been absent.
The only thing I found about the students in the Student First proposal was the implicit promise that if you do this, we'll save money and we won't have to hurt you down the road. There was nothing in the proposal about any of the issues you just read, which I think are all valid. I think these community colleges could do a better job of raising local money. There's more they can do to integrate themselves in those communities. Let's make that happen. And there are better and greater savings in doing it the right way.
Bill Curry is our Democratic political analyst. Thanks as always, Bill.
My pleasure as always.
Thanks also to Paul Bass. He's the editor of the New Haven Independent. He also hosts Dateline New Haven on the great WNHH, the little radio station that they host right there in New Haven. Thanks so much, Paul. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Sammy, and John.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
Check yourself for dandruff, people.
Our program is produced by Scott Breedy. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Thanks to Garner McLaughlin, who assisted on the show. And it's our last day as an intern today.
Oh, no.